Good morning. Today we want to cover our 14th lecture in Exodus, and this is barely scratching the surface. And we're going to discuss sign number 5. And we're almost halfway through the signs if we count all 10 of the quote-unquote plagues as the signs. However, if we're only going to talk about having 9 signs leading up to the Passover and the death of the firstborn, that's not really a sign. That is a result of seeking to live apart from the truth of God. When you seek to live apart from the truth of God, what you end up with is death. You're born spiritually dead because of the indwelling sin nature within you. Since we are all created in the image of Adam. But then there's the physical death. Now, the physical death isn't really death. The soul never dies. Ever, ever, ever. Once God creates the soul, it never dies. What we're calling physical death is when the physical body ceases to have its life force. Then there's that separation of the soul. And the soul goes either to paradise or to hell. There are no options after physical death. There's no purgatory. There's no, I can make it up in eternity future. There is only a slight reprieve when you come out of hell, stand before him at the white throne judgment, and your own works testify against you. And you yourself condemn yourself and acknowledge that he is righteous and holy and just. And you have condemned yourself to eternity in lake of fire. The issue here is not really about torment, though that's what we focus on in this life. The issue is living without the love of God. When we live without the love of God, then we must live for eternity future in the anger of God. There is no third option. The law of excluded middle. There is no third option where you're not in God's love or you're not in God's anger. You're in neutral country. Because neutral country does not exist. Or in Romans 6, you're either a slave to Satan or you're a slave to Christ. There is no third ground. There is no such thing that we call freedom. I've never heard a coherent definition of freedom. Because freedom means I have no constraints. But by definition, a human being with a sin nature who has no constraints is somebody who is totally out of control. Go look at people in the gospel that are totally out of control. They're demonically possessed. Thus, that is freedom. Well, that's not much freedom, is it? So we want to keep in focus here that God is not leading the Hebrew people out of the slavery of Egypt into the freedom to live and do as they wish. That is not happening. They may think that's going to happen, and they may want in their minds for that to happen because they cannot envision what the end result will be if they live that way. But we're going to touch on that in our lecture here. And it's important that we do so. Now, as we always do, we want to review the triads. Because these signs are given in three sets of three. Anytime the Bible does something in threes, it is completeness. It is important. In fact, I would venture to say it's not just important, it is vital that we understand this. You want to understand the holiness of God, then we need to understand what life will be like should we seek to live without God. And he's giving us a preview here in these signs. So in the first triad, what we have here is God warning us of the spiritual consequences of living apart from him. Death. Demonically controlled. First by our own leaders. World leaders. National leaders. Kingdom leaders. Religion leaders. They all speak lies of Satan. Those are the frogs. And guess what? In the flies, we all are tormented by those demonic minions that follow Satan. Oh, there's no love in Satan's camp. No love at all. They're not doing it because they want to promote us. They're doing it so they can promote themselves and escape the judgment that is to come, or so they hope. But it's a forlorn hope. There is no escaping the judgment to come. But in the process, they want to show God that everything that he creates is sinful. And thus, God himself is the author of sin. And we're going to touch on that here in a few moments. Now, well, we'll save that for that part of the lesson when we get there. Because this is the common complaint of man down through history. In fact, you might say this is the whole reason philosophy exists, is to develop an explanation of why God is wrong. So in the first sign of each triad, Moses approaches Pharaoh, the ruler, as in his function as chief priest. Remember, in the ancient kingdoms, the ruler wore two hats. He was both God in his mind, and as God, he was the chief priest, the chief intercessor between his culture and their gods. He was able to do this because he was God also. This, as far as we know, was initiated by Nimrod, as exemplified in the Tower of Babel. That was their religious platform. Not to reach up to heaven. Each man wasn't stupid. We just think he was. But it was to be elevated so everybody could see him in his intercessory role, doing his sacrifices on top of the ziggurat for their behalf. And then the second sign of the triad, Pharaoh is approached as head of government, as king of Egypt, in his governmental official capacity. Now notice this. His government official capacity is secondary to his priestly functions. This is the same as Christ. Christ's priestly functions take precedence over his government functions. And as Isaiah tells us, He has a government. And it's all predicated upon his death, burial, and resurrection on the cross. And then the third sign of each triad strikes at the culture itself, warning them that they are in danger. This is the results of the choices they are making. This is God's mercy. This is God's long-suffering in action. Because to be absolutely honest, as people, we are idiots. We can't just sit down and read a book and say, oh, I understand that, and turn from our wicked ways. Because we have a book, and we spend our time trying to destroy that book and the truth of that book and the truth of God's word. And to be absolutely honest, we are failing. Oh, we may ignore the book. We may say we're going to live apart from the book. But we can't. Because every time that we decide what is right and what is wrong that is consistent with the scriptures, you know what we're doing? We're testifying to the truth of the scriptures, all the while denying it. Because mankind, when he says that murder is wrong, is borrowing from the Bible, the very book he says he's trying to destroy. That is wrong. That is not true. That is, there is no God. But every time he makes a decision in concert with the will of God, he is testifying before God and in his heart that God is real, that God is true, and that his word is true, or they would not have made the decisions that they made, such as murder is wrong, stealing is wrong. And in cultures down through history, we have seen the cultures who move away from these standards disintegrate. Thus, they testify to the truth of God and to the truth of the scriptures. Now, this is going to be the second sign of the second triad. Now, the first triad was basically spiritual, as the physical signs pointed to spiritual problems that, left uncorrected, will result in spiritual death. Just as physical death is a metaphor for the spiritual death, since the soul never ceases to exist, as we said. So the second triad demonstrates the destructive nature of these demonic spiritual forces in the material world. In other words, the consequences of our sin doesn't stop in the spiritual, but we live in a physical material realm. That is what separates us from the angels and the demons. They do not live in a material, physical realm. They live in a spiritual realm. They can come into the physical realm, but they were not made for this realm. We were not made for the spiritual realm. In fact, if we were to have an existence in the spiritual realm, we would be confused. We would not know left from right, up from down, because in the spiritual realm, those directions probably, and I have to say probably because I've never been there, and there's no way I can know, because I have no senses that detect the truth of the spiritual realm. The only thing I have that tells me about the truth of the spiritual realm is the very book I tried to destroy as a lost person. That is the scriptures. There is no other work. There is no other means by which I can understand the spiritual realm. And guess what? The Bible doesn't describe the spiritual realm, because it would be meaningless. How can you put into words that which would have no meaning to us? The closest the Bible comes to doing this is the book of Revelation, from chapter 4 to the end of the book. And guess what? Most of us don't have a clue what that book is saying. We'll read it, and it is incoherent to us. See, that is the final exam of the scriptures. You don't go to, I'm always amused by people who newly saved or the lost people with their degrees and years of learning. Read John because it's easy to read, though it's very difficult to understand in its true depth. And then they'll go to Revelation. Like, I can read that and understand it. Well, no, you can't. Because it's based almost exclusively on Old Testament concepts and precepts and imageries. And if you don't have a thorough, grounded understanding of the Old Testament, Revelation will make even less sense to you. And then you throw your hands up and walk away. And so we need to have this understanding of the Old Testament. And here is where it starts. Genesis was the book of beginnings of why the Old Testament and how it came into being. This is the beginning of the nation of Israel. But it's not just about it's not just about the nation of Israel. It's about the condition of mankind in general and why there was a need for a people to emulate the truth of God, no matter how imperfectly. And these truths, these events here are going to ripple across the ancient world and transform it, preparing it for the coming of Christ. And that leads into the modern age. That leads into our age. Without these events, without these signs, our modern world would never occur. Now, the second triad demonstrates not only these destructive natures, these forces at work, but this second sign of this second triad is going to show us something unique, something that's not happened before in Scripture. So God commands Moses to confront Pharaoh as king of Egypt in his court, which legalizes his request to leave. And he's done this once before. He's doing it again in this one, and he'll do it one more time. And guess what? In his role, he's going to do it three times with Pharaoh as high priest. He's going to do it three times with Pharaoh as king. And then guess what? They're going to leave. Because Pharaoh is going to say, leave. It's because Satan, through Pharaoh, due to the fall of Adam, has judicial control and authority of all governments. Now he has this, and didn't realize this till I taught in the book of Genesis after years of study. But you know, governments were begun by Cain in an effort to keep sinful man who had rejected God from spiraling out of control and destroying himself. It was Cain who developed cities, and cities demand a government because people are herded together into very close quarters. In the ancient world, they were what we call missile-packed density. They're right in on top of each other. And you have to have rules, or you'll have lots of dead people. A sinful man does not willingly live well with others. Because that's what sin does. It wants to destroy both those around the person who's sinful, as well as destroying the sinful person, him or herself. And God does not countenance rebellion at all in any form. Thus, Pharaoh has to give permission, legal permission for the people to leave. That's another reason we have these series of signs. Now, pestilence, this fear of death, has been with man Well, there's this man's been able to write and write about it, or at least the writings that we have. And as I mentioned, we do not see pestilence in the book of Genesis. Now, it has to exist because Job lived during the time of Genesis, and we see that he himself was struck with pestilence, but not his friends. That was a unique case, and we see it from the hand of Satan as allowed and whose boundaries or effects had been determined by God. And it brought Job to salvation. Pestilence from here on out, when we see it, we're going to see it in a twofold manner, both as a consequence of sin and as a rod of God to let us know that we are in sin and to move us back toward Him on a national level. In the Old Testament, it's always on a national level. And until the 20th century, pestilence or plagues were uncontrollable. There were no antibiotics. There were no antimicrobials. There were no vaccines. There was nothing. You either got it or you didn't. You either healed from it or you didn't. But 20th century, with the development of these medications and practices, brought or ushered in a golden age of medicine. Now we could concentrate on other things like depression and anxiety and post-traumatic stress and hyperactivity, all these essential important things of life that are caused by the sin nature living in freedom, so-called, raging out of control. See, sin always finds an expression. And yet, even today, God has raised up things, pestilences, that we can't control. Like in the mid-1980s, you had AIDS, HIV, which, when it ran its course, led to acquired immune deficiency. Or you can't protect, your body cannot protect you anymore, and you die of something quickly and horribly. Because we couldn't cure it. We can't cure it. We've done some things to try and control it so you live longer, but we cannot stop it. Even today, we live in fear. Swine flu, bird flu, Ebola. See, the pestilence is raising its ugly head again, warning us, not just on a national level, but on a world level, that we are living in great sin. And that we have no control over these things. We think we do, but we don't. Pharaoh thought he had control, but he doesn't. So the intercessory request is to let my people go. And if you do not do this, I will strike your livestock with pestilence. Once again, God showing mercy and grace, but also consequences of their choices. Mercy and grace in the fact that he's striking their livestock and not them. Now, there are diseases that strike herds that don't strike people. Like hoof and mouth disease. And so, God is merciful, he's long-suffering, and he's saying, see, this is going to result in death. But this is just an example, striking your herd. Now, it's also to do something else, it's to strike them economically. Because we only pay attention when it hits the pocketbook, or hits our body. Basically, those are the two realms in which we react. You strike my pocketbook, I'm going to get upset. You strike my body, I'm going to panic. You strike his pocketbook, and I don't care. But you strike my pocketbook and threaten my livelihood and my ability to have shelter, to have food, to have pleasures. And I'm not going to be happy about it. But guess what? He spares the Hebrews. Not because they're righteous, not because they're holy, not because they're just, not because they're better, not because of anything about them other than God chose them. God spares his people some things today, not so they can escape the consequences, because remember, discipline starts at the house of God first. We see this time and again in the New Testament. It begins at church. It begins with the people of God. Thus, we need to look upon this with great trepidation, that we are held more strictly accountable than the lost are for living the godly life. Now, we don't live the godly life to escape the judgment of God. We live the godly life because we have the nature of God, and it flows from us naturally. Yet remember, we still have the sinful flesh, and they battle against each other. And to be honest, we're lazy folk. So God has to guide us along, so to speak. So this is why the Hebrews' livestock will be spared. And also to let them know that it is of God. It was just everybody's livestock got hit. Then the Egyptians could just say it's not of God. It's just chance. Just happenstance. So it's not God and I can ignore it. Now, as we talked about, there is no example of pestilence in Genesis. The first time this word is used in the Hebrews is in Exodus chapter 5, verse 3, when the Hebrews themselves use it, which lets us know that this is not a new thing, that it's been around. And it's always been seen as coming from God. And you have to see it as that way because you have no means of controlling it. And you do not know what causes it. And you do not know how to break the cycle of it. Thus, it ravages you. But it is indeed the hand of God. And when the Hebrews use it, they use it wrongly. They're telling Pharaoh, if you don't let us go out in the wilderness and worship our God and do as he commands us, he will strike us with pestilence. Now, God never told them this. God never threatened them with this. This is their own making up of it. Of course, Pharaoh's not impressed because if I don't let you go, God is going to kill you. But if I let you go, I'm going to lose you anyway. So I might as well just watch you die. Have some popcorn and watch the show. And see if your God is really that angry. Because see, that's not maintaining mayat. His job is to maintain harmony, to maintain balance, to, quote unquote, prevent these things from striking Egypt. But if your God is going to strike you because something I do, well, that's not much of a God. And we'll just sit back and watch you die and laugh. So it didn't work for them. Now, what do we actually know about pestilence? Well, in the mid-19th century, Louis Pasteur, who was not the only one, by the way, who came up with the understanding of the germ theory, he built on the work of others. He showed through experimentation that there are living agents that cause diseases. And he developed the concept of vaccines. Now, he was working against smallpox, similar to cowpox. So if you as a person got cowpox, it struck you only in a mild manner, but it developed an immunity in you they help protect you against smallpox, which is not a small matter. It would kill you. It would ravage you. Some people could fight it off and survive, but their faces and bodies would be all pockmarked. That's why it's called pox. And as we begin to look into this more aggressively, and with developing technology and knowledge more thoroughly, we defined it as being caused by viruses or bacterium or by fungus or parasites, another one-celled, multi-celled, usually one-celled creatures, amoebas, and so on and so forth. But, you know, we're very good at wanting to do find causes and to explain things. According to Nietzsche, what differentiates modern man from ancient man is our ability to explain things. We don't have any more knowledge of the causation of things. When I say causation, I mean of the spiritual forces or the metaphysical forces at work in the world. We still don't know what gravity is. We still don't know what magnetism is. We still don't know what electricity is. We don't know what causes, you know, what heat is. We don't know anything about these forces. We don't even know what light is. But we can explain them better, and we can control them to some degree. And thus, we think we're better. But, you know, what we miss is the understanding of the spiritual, physical, causative links. And here we're going to talk about cleanliness. Because cleanliness breaks the cycle of infection. You know, passing it from one person to another person to another person. Well, in the medical field, we call the vector. If we can break that transmission anywhere along that chain, then we can help stop the spread of that infection or the pestilence. So, but you know, if you're physically unclean, you're spiritually unclean. Because how you think on the inside determines what you are on the outside. So if we are spiritually unclean, we're not going to consider physical cleanliness an important trait. That's where you develop the adage, cleanliness is next to godliness. Now, God has to develop this first in the Hebrew people because there are a multiplicity of laws concerning cleanliness. When to wash your hands, when to wash your feet, where to poop, where to pee at, how to consider yourself unclean, and how to deal with that uncleanliness. And it helped to keep them more disease-free than the surrounding neighbors, which would tend to make them want to come and learn why. And so this is one of the reasons that God instituted many of those rules, and we understand that today. So pestilence does not thrive in clean environments. It thrives in filthy, dirty social conditions. It promotes the spread of diseases, especially when you're tightly packed. But you know, that's exactly what herds are. They're filthy, because animals don't care. Animals just pee and poop where they stand. You get the urge, you dump. You get the urge, eat. You get the urge, copulate. You get the urge, you sleep. You just plop down in it. You ever seen a herd of cows? And you think, wow, I'm sure glad they wash them up before they go down the store and buy them, because these filthy animals. And herds, by definition, are packed together. And so one gets sick, often they all get sick. It just runs like wildfire through them. Thus, they're susceptible to pestilence. So whole herds have to be eliminated to stop the spread of diseases, even today. Here we are in 2015, destroying hundreds of thousands of chickens and turkeys to stop the spread of bird flu. I mean, out of control. So the Bible shows God allows pestilence. Man brings pestilence on himself through his rejection of God. We see this in the cycle in Romans 1, verses 18 through 32, that as man rejected the knowledge of God, God gave him up. And God and man decided to worship the elements of nature rather than the creator of nature. And in the final stage, we see that man is so degraded himself that even the natural use of his bodies he has perverted, and all manner of evil concupiscence flows from this unnatural usage, and diseases and come forth, and the behaviors that are associated with sin are just rampant, even down to being disobedient to parents, which is lumped right in there with murder. And this can be traced throughout the Bible. God tells the Jews in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28, that if the Jews turn from God, if they turn away and decide to live in sin, that they will be struck with pestilence, both because they'll start living more uncleanly, thus promoting the spread of disease, and also because God will allow it in his mercy to warn them that they are moving away from him and encourage them to move back to him. And there's actually a very good example of this in 2 Samuel 24 and 1 Chronicles 21, where Israel and David are so prideful that they're flaunting their pride before God and numbering the people. And God, with the choice of David, strikes the nation with 3 days of pestilence until David sees the angel standing over Jerusalem with the sword drawing at the threshing floor, ready to strike Jerusalem itself. And David repents. And thus, that is where they built the temple at. Now, people can avoid the pestilence if people return to God, repenting of their sin, and seek God's forgiveness and salvation, then he will heal them. This is the famous promise God gave to Israel that many Christians try to apply to America today. In 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verses 11 through 14. That's a misapplication of that to nations today, though, because Israel has been the only theocracy in man's history, because God has only agreed to lead Israel. That was back then, and they rejected that, and God rejected them. They were off into captivity, and when they came back, they were no longer a nation. They were no longer a theocracy. And then, as a people themselves, when they rejected Christ and put him on the cross through the help of the Romans, God just gave them up for a long time. In fact, even today, the nation that has come back to call itself Israel today is no more of God, is no more of the scripture than the man on the moon coming down and setting up a government anywhere. In other words, this is not the Israel that's going to be regathered. This is a socialistic group that has no ties to God, by and large, who have provided a haven for those who claim to be Orthodox, but are no more than modern emulations of the Pharisaical sect that tormented Christ in his day. Thus, the purpose of pestilence is to turn people to God. Now, pestilence can be applied at the individual level, the lesson of pestilence. Because when you get sick, you turn to God. We turn first to the temples. You know, the signs, the medicus, and the staff of Achilles, I believe, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, are both ancient Grecian Roman symbols of healing. So it comes from Gnostic paganism. And actually, those symbols go back even earlier than that. So we go down to the temple, the hospitals, and consult the high priest, well, actually the doctors, and have them either prescribe us a drug or cut on us or do whatever in hopes of being healed. Like I said, in the golden age of medicine, that worked very well. But that doesn't work so well today because our sin has gotten even more out of control because of that. So the purpose of pestilence is to turn us to God. And we find a New Testament example of this in the four horsemen of the apocalypse in the book of Revelation. The first horseman is Satan. And with Satan always goes war, famine, pestilence. Always. And you see this triad throughout the Old Testament too. And so God is allowing Satan to go forth, and what follows him is war, famine, and pestilence. And in today's world, as the Western societies have rejected the morality of the Bible, have rejected their so-called Christian backgrounds or foundational principles, there's been more wars and famines and pestilence around the world. In fact, the world's become very dangerous. But it's not become dangerous just because there are more people. But it's become dangerous because sin is allowed to be unchecked. And when man lives in freedom, that is, uncontrolled restraint, the more uncontrolled he becomes, the more there is wars and fightings among you, according to James. And with wars and fightings, you have famine because you have poor distribution of food. And when you have poor distribution systems, not only do you have poor distribution of food, but of other items. And you live unclean. You live in filth. You no longer have the medications that you might need to stop this, and pestilence follows. Now, these are not sent by judgments of God to torment man, but these are the results of man wanting to live apart from God. And God is saying, this is the result of your actions. Wake up, turn away from this, come back, come to me. I want to say come back, we never were with him, but turn to God. This is the consequences of our sin. And I drew the schematic here to show this, that God gave them up to their dreams. Once again, that's Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32. And God gave them up. First, Satan promotes sin in man via rebellion. We see this in Genesis 3. We see it every day in our own lives, lives of those around us. And the people followed the lie of Satan to control their own lives. Now, I should have italicized the word control because actually, you have no control. The more you sin, the more uncontrollable you become. The more out of control you are, the more you... wars, fightings among you. And we see this in the general decline of cleanliness in our own culture today. And the spread of diseases. Because as we are sexually immoral, denoting our spiritual immorality, these pestilence are ravaging us. And the results are war, famine, pestilence, which leads to death. This is the false claim of theodicy. The man claims that God promotes harm to man as punishment for sin to force man to do good. Actually, this is a false argument. It's a false question because it forces a conclusion that God must be evil. But that is the wrong question to ask. And as Christians, we must not accept this question as a question suitable to discuss. Because it really is the wrong question. If you discuss this question, you must come to the conclusion that God is evil, no matter which side you take. But actually, What's happening is God allows man to experience the results of his own leadership. Actually, Satan's leadership through him, to promote his repentance and encourage his salvation. So theodicy is false. God is not the author of evil. But he has allowed evil because it is the only way to develop an experiential knowledge and understanding of God. In other words, God cannot create a people to fellowship with. Then they would be gods. But we're not. We never will be. We'll be adopted into the family of God. But the only way to learn is the same way you learn a profession. Experience. You can't just read out of a book. You have to read out a book and go try it. And that's how you develop a working knowledge. And then God provides an escape from man's own hell, which is grace. But Pharaoh, he's like us. He's a slow learner. Pharaoh saw the results of his sin, death of all the Egyptian livestock, and the sparing of all the Hebrews' livestock. But Pharaoh rejected God's grace, and he made his heart heavy. Remember, according to Egyptian mythology, when you die, you go to this place and your heart is weighed. And if it is heavier than this feather, it is eaten. And your trip to the afterlife just ended right there. So it's a very great burden when you make your heart heavy. And you know you're making your heart heavy. And Pharaoh knows God is true. That's why he's making his heart heavy, because he's still rejecting. He's not going to give up his position. And to be absolutely honest, he cannot. His mind can't comprehend the things of God. My mind cannot comprehend the things of God when I was lost. Yes, I read the Bible. Yes, I studied these things, but I also studied witchcraft. I studied psychology. I studied many things trying to find truth. But I could never find truth until God illuminated me. Thus, we are the same today. Because man, you know, he has rejected the idea that immorality has caused the spread of HIV and AIDS. You almost cannot even bring this up in a discussion. It has become a social issue rather than a disease issue. Thus, AIDS has gone unchecked through certain populations. In Africa, it's usually the heterosexual immoral population. In the Western countries, it's usually the homosexual immoral population. But what's the commonality? Sexually immoral. Which means you're also spiritually immoral. One's just further down the chain of rebellion than the other, and they don't want to recognize that. Thus, they inhibit the speech, thinking that if we can't talk about it, it'll go away. It won't be true. And of course, that never happens. So, and, of course, we have newer diseases today, as I talked about, such as Ebola and those things. So what is the results of pestilence? Man continues to reject God. Man would rather live in a world that he controls rather than submit to God, living with God's peace. In other words, we would rather live with wars, famine, pestilence, and blame each other, and eventually blame God, than to repent and live under God. Modern man is walking in Pharaoh's footsteps, enjoying the fruits of our sin, worshiping the very forces that are destroying him. War, famine, and pestilence. America has more holidays developed around its military than even around God. And the one that we do have, Christmas, we have perverted. So we have destroyed its meaning, seeking to find peace on earth by us not having wars and killing each other, all the while having more wars and killing each other. It's amazing how that happens. You look at American history, we have very, very, very few periods of actual peace, non-military aggression. A lack of military aggression there. We are a warring nation, and we worship our military. And with that comes wars. Now, so far, we have not enjoyed much in the way of the famine and the pestilence in our country because of our warring, but we've taken that out to others. So they've had to enjoy the famine and the pestilence when we fight wars on their soil. So Pharaoh does not let the people go. We do not let our sin go. We love our sin. We refuse to understand the truth of God. We refuse to bow to the truth of God. And guess what? We're going to have another sign from God showing us what it means to live apart from the truth of God. And it's not a pleasant experience. Thank you.